We start off tonight with Michael Corcoran, a Boston-based journalist whose writing has appeared in the Boston Globe, The Nation magazine, the Christian Science Monitor, truthout.org, and many other publications. And we're very happy to welcome Michael to our program tonight. Michael, appreciate you making time to be with us.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So there's a lot to think about, and we've been certainly in our own small way on this program trying to take stock of the big issues that are going to be launched into public debate here as the Trump administration takes power on January 20th. And your article, again, the title of which is Playing Defense, How Progressives Could Push Democrats to Block the Trump Agenda, addresses a key element in, a key element in the folks who are going to be rallying, at least in Capitol Hill, some of them, to stop the worst excesses of the Trump agenda, or at least try. And your article not only addresses the tools available to politicians in Washington, but also some of the concerns that Democrats may cave in, that Democrats have a history of being weak-kneed and timid in their opposition. And that is a big concern. But it does seem, of course, that the Democratic Party is taking stock of its many flaws here in this defeat, although, of course, we have to reiterate that many more voters supported the Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton than did they who supported Mr. Trump. I think that's up to, 2.8 million votes more for Hillary than for Trump. That's the latest popular vote totals that I've been reading. But at any rate, Michael, maybe I can have you speak a bit about, where you started from in this article addressing the defense mechanisms that could be kicked in by talking about the Trump agenda. What is it that you think we have to be most concerned about as Mr. Trump and his team take power in Washington?
Yeah, well, it's difficult to answer that question, if only because it's so hard to believe what Donald Trump says, and because he said so many things that have countered other things that he said. You know, for instance, on the campaign trail, he was among the few Republicans that didn't, just kind of express an unmitigated desire to wreck the social safety net and destroy Medicare. But now that he's making cabinet appointments, it looks like that was probably insincere, and he seems to be very much adopting some of those regressive, more typical GOP policies. So it is, of course, difficult to predict what Trump is going to be. But if we take him at his word on some of these issues, and if we look at some of his appointments and some of what he said, I think the biggest issues that we can one, of course, would be global warming because of the stakes, which is, the existential threat to the species and our survival on the planet. And he appears to be ready to stack the EPA. He's already doing it, as you mentioned, with a bunch of, climate deniers, flat earthers, I joke sometimes. But, that is really scary. He's made climate denial official U.S. policy. And there's only so much we can do to stop that. In addition to that, he's going to repeal. Repeal is a complicated word because it's going to take numerous steps, and it won't be very as simple as it sounds. But he's going to dismantle to the best as he can the benefits we've gained from the Affordable Care Act, which has given healthcare to another. It's taken the uninsurance rate down from about 17% to 12%. And so that's another big one, is that it seems hard to imagine he would ignore that issue. And then, of course, I guess if I had to pick a third issue, it would just be the threat to the First Amendment, the ability for the press to speak freely, the fear of groups to protest, particularly minority groups, just because of such a fervor of racial nationalism behind his campaign. I mean, that adds a whole new sprinkle to the already unsettling elements of the GOP that we've been dealing with for some time now. That adds a whole new chauvinistic, authoritarian hue to neoliberalism that I think scares scares me, and I'm sure it scares others. So those are just some of the things, but, you know, you could, it seems like there's so many scary possibilities that, like you said, we take stock the best we can, but, I mean, who knows, right? On some level, there's so much at stake, and we don't really know exactly what his agenda will be. But those are a few of the things that stick out, for sure.
Thanks for that good summary there, Michael. What, as you researched the tools available to an opposition party, the minority party in Congress, now that the Republicans control all three major branches of government, the legislature, the White House, as well as the Supreme Court, what is it that the Democratic Party is capable of doing to throw a monkey wrench in Mr. Trump's agenda?
Well, their best bet, I mean, as far as we're going procedurally, the place where they're the least weak is the Senate. I believe right now I think it's 52 to 48. Forgive me if I'm off by, I think that's it. Of course, in the event of a tie, that would go to Mike Pence. So in any event, they're only two or three votes down in the Senate. So when it comes to anything that needs to be passed by the Senate, Republicans are going to need, even if they use a reconciliation, and I don't want to get too technical here, but in instances where they need at least 50 votes, the Democrats would only need to pick off two or three Republicans. So, you know, and I don't know if, you know, I won't give any specific examples now, but someone like Rand Paul, who has some civil libertarian sentiments, you know, he might not like all of the appointments that Trump makes, and he might be willing to, you know, make strange bedfellows with some of the Democrats, or Suzanne Collins, I think it is, from Maine, who's more moderate. So, yeah, that is an area where the Republicans don't have, it's not like they have a supermajority like the Democrats had for a little bit in 2009. They will need to have uniformity of, in order to pass something that even requires, basically, to pass something that requires even 50 votes. Now, one thing that has to be mentioned is that on certain areas, including appointments, they only need 50 votes now, not 60, because Harry Reid did away with the filibuster to help get all of the appointments that the GOP was obstructing that Obama had. So, so they will have the filibuster as an option on some levels. On the Supreme Court, they can still use the filibuster, and on certain other areas, they can use the filibuster. If the Trump and the GOP want to pass something using reconciliation, which only requires 51 votes, or 50 votes for the Republicans, then they can also try to pick off some allies there. So that is their place where they're the least weak, and where they, if they are willing to fight, might have some small victories. I mean, they're still going to lose a lot of these battles, but that is one area.
So. We're speaking with Michael Corcoran, a Boston-based journalist, and we're talking about his recent article that appeared in truthout.org, the title of which is Playing Defense: How Progressives Could Push Democrats to Block the Trump Agenda. And as you noted, Michael, the Republican Party instituted a total war strategy and a host of tactics to obstruct President Obama's administration when he took power in 2009. And they were quite successful and not really held accountable by the public for those obstructive tactics, you know, and given the fact that this election, by vote count, the Republicans lost, but they still had a lot of support out there. What is your view of the Democrats' predilection to adopt the Republican Party's total war tactics here? They haven't seemed to do that in the past, given other Republican administrations going back to the Reagan era, the first George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. They seem to go along and get along on a lot of the critical policy decisions that were made in Washington during those years.
Yeah, so, and I do think, and it might sound hypocritical in some sense for people on the left or progressives or however you want to label it, to say the Democrats should be obstructionists, because one common critique is, oh, you're not letting Congress do its job, et cetera, et cetera. But the Republicans did show, even when they didn't have a lot of power, in, say, 2009, 2010, when the Affordable Care Act was being adopted, and they were so militantly opposed, you know, they had the Democrats, you know, debating with themselves and conceding things to industry and conceding things to members of their own party. So in many ways, especially on things, like I mentioned earlier, on things like global warming or also reproductive rights, there's certain issues where I think they'll be able to rally and to be uniformed in their opposition to the Trump. On some areas, say infrastructure, there might be some pressure for them to make common cause. And I guess the devil is in the details, but my biggest fear is that if there is going to be a coalition where some Democrats work with the Republicans, it's probably not going to be, and it could be, you know, but it's probably not going to be Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and that wing of the party. I think it would be more likely to be the more conservative Democrats that are being pressured and lobbied so heavily by industry. And so say they want to come up with some kind of tax deal or they want to cut Medicare and entitlement reform. And then you could see a few of the more conservative Democrats aligning themselves with Trump, and that would help the Democrats satiate industry and keep them funding their campaigns and so on. So I do think obstruction on some level could be a valuable tactic and should be used at least, I mean, the devil's in the details, but at least on several areas where they, and even on issues where they're going to lose, even on issues where obstruction is not enough. They need to, in order to get the base rallied, in order for them to want to kick out the Republicans in 2018, kick out Trump in 2020, to convince working class voters that they are a party that they can get behind, they're going to have to show opposition, you know, on a very, in a very staunch and militant way. So, I don't necessarily want to say it's a uniform policy of obstructionism, but it should be a tool they use quite a bit, I suspect, given the likely agenda that's coming ahead. And I also think that it's incumbent on the public to pressure them to do it, because they are not inclined to do it on their own often, largely because of that the pressure from industry, which I mentioned earlier.
Michael, what are the signals that we've seen so far from Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York and Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader from California? What have they been saying about their tactics here when Trump comes in as president?
There's been some mixed signals. There are, and I linked to this in the article, I think there was an article in the Times recently, and there were some quotes where Schumer and others were seeking to, quote, align with Trump on some issues. Now, how much of this is serious or how much of it is political posturing to pressure Trump, you know, who knows? But so that's a concern. And I recall when Schumer said they were looking for ways to align with Trump, that there was a blowback from progressive organizations like Democracy for America and others who are saying, you know, we can't play, I'm paraphrasing, but Democracy for America said, stop playing footsie with Donald Trump, because one, we don't want to normalize him, and two, it's hard to imagine any kind of coalition where the policies will be that good. And another issue is, of course, Bernie Sanders has said if Trump comes out for an infrastructure policy that benefits the working class, I would be willing to work with him then. But I also think Sanders, if you could put truth serum in him, doesn't expect Trump's policies to probably meet his standards. There's been some statements that are open to working with them. But on the other hand, Nancy Pelosi, who you mentioned, she has gone and said she will do what it takes to protect Medicare, and that's incredibly important, especially in light of I think it's Price that was just appointed to Health and Human Services.
Tom Price, right?
Yes, exactly. And so early signs are mixed, and it'll be hard to know for sure. But now and of course I'm watching the news today, so clearly Democrats, many Democrats are pretty militant against. I mean, some of them are trying to keep him out of the White House now. I won't get into all the details, but with the Russian interference and the Hamilton electors, so that seems to be a sign of militance in opposition to Trump. So that could be, you know, a sign of them wanting to be militant, but I won't believe it until I see it, you know, which is another reason why I advocate that progressives, you know, demand that Democrats try, you know, really genuinely try to stop Trump when they can, and not to, you know, try to work with him, at least not too often or on certain issues.
Michael, Donald Trump will be coming into the White House with enormous corporate support. We've seen the stock market rally.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen a succession of these millionaires and billionaires and captains of industry. The CEO of Exxon, one of the largest corporations in the world, is possibly going to be tapped as Secretary of State. And a whole roster of either corporate CEOs or politicians that have been aligned for many, many years with corporate interests. As they come into power, and the power that campaign contributions brings, it seems that you're going to have a Democratic Party that may want to go along to get along versus coming under pressure by progressive activist groups out there in the country that don't want to see the Democrats move in a direction of playing ball with Trump. What leverage do activist groups have in the country to push the Democrats in a direction of more confrontation and less cooperation?
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think, right, you know, just broadly speaking, especially since Citizen United, the biggest weakness voters have and the public has is that when Congress is sitting there in Washington being bombarded by lobbyists who fund their campaigns, and this includes most Democrats, not all of them, you know, it's hard for them to, you know, it's sometimes they prioritize the needs of the industry who they require versus the public. So the public pressure has to be overwhelming in order to force them to pay attention to it. But when you talk about leverage, one thing that is a new variable that has not been the case is that someone like Bernie Sanders is arguably the most popular politician in the Democratic caucus, and Elizabeth Warren is very popular. Neither of them get money from, you know, Wall Street, for instance, and they might be the only two senators in the entire caucus that don't get funded on some level from Wall Street. So because those two senators are so popular, that could be an avenue for activists to try to align with them and urge them to make statements from the pulpits that they have and use the windows that they have, because that is a new variable, the fact that we have some progressive leaders that are actually, you know, sort of progressive and have shown to have a following. And Bernie Sanders could make conservative Democrats' lives rather difficult if he wants to, because he has such a coalition behind him. And one other point I'll make is I was reading the website for Physicians for a National Health Plan, and they were talking about how Trump will likely repeal the Affordable Care Act, and that's terrible because it's going to leave so many people without insurance, and that's all true. But she noted that now, because that might happen, someone like Elizabeth Warren, who has been, not really willing to speak out in favor of single payer because she doesn't want to appear to be undermining the Affordable Care Act, well, she might be liberated now to speak out for single payer. And in fact, she has come out quite recently and said the Affordable Care Act wasn't bold enough and so on. So those are sometimes, because they're going to dismantle some of the good things Obama has done, progressives could come back and say, well, you know, those weren't good enough. We need to come at them from a stronger position. So maybe a coalition behind something stronger than the Affordable Care Act, maybe a public option, or they could ideally fight for single payer. But those are some new variables, the fact that Bernie Sanders has such a following, and so that might be a way to pressure industry. All that said, the pressure from industry and the amount of money they have and the amount of lobbies they have, it is still an uphill battle, which is why it's so incumbent on the public to organize and stay patient even through the inevitable losses that are to come.
Well, Michael, just a final quick question. We only have about a minute left, but what can you tell us about the contest for who's going to lead the Democratic Party, who's going to become the next chair of the Democratic National Committee? We know that Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison is in the running. There's been some criticism of him, a lot of it judged to be very unfair. But how important is that post, and who do you think is going to win it?
Yes, so I would. My personal preference would be Keith Ellison, and that's, you know, the position isn't the most powerful position in the world, but at this point, symbolically, I think it means something. And even though someone like Chuck Schumer, you know, is very more conservative than other Democrats, more establishment than other Democrats, he has actually come out in favor of Keith Ellison, which shows, I think, he at least acknowledges that they need to do something to placate their progressive base. So I think the general sentiment is progressives are hoping Ellison will get it. The White House doesn't want Ellison. They have been lobbying against him. And like you mentioned, there's been a smear campaign. He's, you know, he said bad things about Israel. He's too radical. I saw an article that said he's being reverend righted, essentially. So there is the fact that he's being attacked that hard means he's got some of his opponents. But I think it would be best if Keith Ellison would get the job. That said, we should have no illusions. Whether it's Ellison or someone else, we shouldn't be lulled into the thought that if it is Ellison that the Democrats have now seen the light and no longer need to feel the pressure from an angry public about something. So I think Ellison's the best case, but I think the job of the activists and the progressives will remain the same, whether it's Ellison or whether it's someone that's more identified with the establishment, which is what the White House is hoping to lobby for.
Well, Michael, thanks so much for talking with us tonight about your article. Again, it's titled Playing Defense, How Progressives Could Push Democrats to Block the Trump Agenda. That appears at truthout.org, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
And please leave our listeners with any other web addresses where they can find your articles, which are
truthout.org. My name's Michael Corcoran. I shall have an article coming out soon about the Affordable Care Act, probably in the next week or so. So if they want to check that out, I encourage them to. Truthout is, I think it's a valuable resource at this point going forward into these troubling times.
So. All right. Well, listen, thanks so much, Michael. We'll stay in touch. I know there's going to be a lot to talk about in the next 4 years.
I absolutely agree. Likewise. And thanks so much for having me on.
Take care, Mike.
Have a nice night.
Good night.
Take care.